This is Leo Babeu for KTWH, that's Two Harbors Community Radio at 99.5 FM, online at ktwh.org. We have a special edition today of what we call our Wandering Nature News bi-weekly feature, and I've got my usual co-host here, Michaela Rice, the DNR naturalist from Gooseberry Falls State Park, and I've got on the line with me, I believe from Duluth, right? Margie Menzies from Hawk Ridge Bird Observatory.
That's correct. I live in Duluth.
Great. A lot of the action is now centered on Duluth among folks that are following migratory patterns of raptors and other large birds. And I'm just grateful that you could join us today, Margie. It's that time of year. I don't even know how you have time to talk to us, but thanks for making time. Because, right, the birds are flying. The birds just keep going by, and I know you got a lot
they
of people
sure
up there.
Do.
Yeah. So, Margie, could you fill us in a little bit on how long you've been education director at Hawk Ridge and your a little on your background and educational training and experience that got you there?
Sure. I am in year number 13 at Hawk Ridge. I started as a naturalist in 2011 and have been working on things and been serving as the education program person really last 5 years or so, and finally am a full-time year-round employee as of January this year. So
Wow. Things
have shifted during that time, but my background is as an educator. I've taught in both public schools and charter schools, but I've also done a lot of naturalist work, so I've been kind of back and forth between the formal classroom and the non-formal classroom. And yeah, ultimately decided, I mean, I do love teaching because I'm a science nerd to the max, but yeah, I finally kind of got to the point in my life where I was like, I need to teach outside stuff all the time. So I went back to my naturalist roots and have been having just an amazing time as education director at Hawk Ridge. I get to talk birds all day, every day, all the time.
You get to talk about winged beings to bipeds, I assume. There are also some dogs in the crowd, but is your audience, your student audience, a little older than when you started out in your career, on average?
Yeah, on average. And I have found that I love, 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 love teaching adults. So, yeah, it's a fun, fun thing for me. I love teaching kids, too. I mean, there's nothing that replaces the magic that you see in kids' eyes, but you can see it in adults too. And so, yeah, it's great fun. I've spent a long time being an instructor for the Minnesota Master Naturalist class. Love teaching that. Yeah, it's just a great opportunity to work with interested folks. So do a lot of different kinds of education. You can basically, I always say, I get to teach fun stuff all the time and I don't have to give any tests. Yeehaw.
That makes you a very popular teacher, I suppose. But also, it is wondrous when you have a group of people who have assembled out of their own choice to be pursuing something that they have some kind of passion or deep curiosity for, I bet.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow. At this juncture, I think it's time to let loose the naturalist, Margie. Are you ready for going into deeper bird talk with Michaela? I guess I would, as the kind of layperson in the three-way exchange here, kind of ask Margie to sum up for people. Everybody's heard of Hawk Ridge, but can you encapsulate what is the magic and what is the thing that goes on in the lives of an enormous number of birds and that ridge in Duluth, Minnesota?
Absolutely. Hawk Ridge, I always say to folks that it's not a bad place to hang out, even if absolutely nothing is flying, because it's a gorgeous overview of Lake Superior, former beachfront property, so to speak, of Lake Superior at a different point geologically speaking. And yeah, it's just an amazing place to stand and look and watch what's happening in the world around us. You can see the big lake, you can see the lift bridge, you can see a really good view of what's coming from the north, which so many of these birds are. So it's just a really great place to hang out. And the numbers of birds that come through are just magical. We typically count on average 60 to 75,000 raptors every year, but we count everything else as well. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of birds coming through every year when you consider all of the birds that are making use of this pathway. So it's just magical. A good, you know, it's not unusual for us to have a day, several days in the fall where our numbers, our count numbers for the day are going to be in the 12, 15,000, 18,000 birds easily. And that just that kind of quantity is just eye-catching and heart-catching. I mean, it's just magical to see that many things moving together.
Oh, yeah. By the way, anyone joining us late here this morning, we're speaking with Margie Menzies, the education director at Hawk Ridge Bird Observatory. If you could clarify exactly organizationally, you know, what kind of human project is it to do all this counting? You're not individually yourself making all those counts. What kind of organization does it take to make that happen?
Yeah, well, we have a lot of things going on at Hawk Ridge. We basically say we have three main departments. We have education, we have the counters, who are really the ones that are doing the hardcore identification and getting the numbers down. And then we also have our banders, who are catching and banding these birds as well. Some of them anyway, not all of them, not by any means, but there's a solid research contingent to what we're doing. Hawk Ridge proper is owned by the city of Duluth, but managed by Hawk Ridge Bird Observatory. So we oversee all the things that happen on the 365 acres or so that we have in the area. So there's all kinds of stuff going on. There's more than 4 miles of trails. There's lots of ways to enjoy what's going on at Hawk Ridge.
Does this happen largely through volunteerism?
There are plenty of volunteers, but no, our counters are paid staff, our educators are paid staff, and our banders are also paid staff. And yeah, we are your typical nonprofit that is
yes,
very dependent on membership and selling merchandise. We have our great trailer at the site, so you can get your Hawk Ridge style and hats and t-shirts and all of that kind of stuff. And then, you know, all the education programming and workshops and things that we do contribute to that ability for us to be able to have those paid staff.
Money contributed to the cause primarily is spent on the human resources it takes to do a good job of this. And for anyone's confused by the word observatory, there really isn't an observatory building of any sort, is there? I mean, there's a trailer.
Yeah, there's the trailer, and I always say if you count the three porta potties, those are also the buildings.
There's your infrastructure. Okay.
Yeah, your indoor structure.
At this point, is this point in the festivities, I'm going to turn it over for more biology inquisition here, inquiring minds of our naturalist, Michaela Rice, who's chomping at the bit. There you go, Michaela. It's all yours.
All right, pass the ball. So I'm going to just dig right in. Can you talk a little bit more about this pathway, this bird pathway that you mentioned?
Sure. Basically, most of the birds that are coming through Hawk Ridge as migrators are birds that live in the boreal forest to the north of us, some of Minnesota, but also to the north of us, a big chunk of Canada is boreal forest. And every year, just put this in your brain and figure it out, but every year, 3 to 5 billion birds leave the boreal forest headed south. It's just eye-popping kind
that
of
is,
numbers.
I'm still kind of stuttering at that.
can't see it on the radio, but Michaela's taken aback.
No, yeah, numbers confuse me. I'm really, wow. I was like, wow. Can you explain, or maybe I can take a stab at it, right? So they are coming south, and the boreal forest is very wide, right? It covers a very large area in Canada. And as they move south, they hit landscape features such as the Great Lakes, which are huge bodies of water that they don't want to fly over, right? That's risky for them. And so they'll take the shore, and they get kind of funneled into the west part of Lake Superior, right, over Duluth. And then if you could talk about the geology a little, too.
Yeah, there's a couple things I would add in there. Yeah. They will wisely stay in habitat as long as they possibly can.
Okay.
So they could head due south, you know, the shortest distance is a straight line, but they don't do that because they can stay in familiar habitat and enjoy their normal stuff and have a good idea where to hunt to find their foods and what to look for and that sort of stuff. And so it can be a less stressful process by staying in habitat. So they do that, and that tends to, both from the east and the west, funnel them right straight to the top of Lake Superior.
That's really
interesting. And when you hit Lake Superior, you got a choice. If you can handle flying over 160 miles or 170 miles of water straight across, some do, but not very many. Most of them are going to opt to stay on the land side of things because, quite honestly, there's just plain old-fashioned not much out there on the big lake, 160 miles of open water, no place to land, nothing to eat for many of these birds. And the other thing that many of these birds depend on is warm air columns and thermals that develop over the land, but they don't develop over the water. And so many of these good soaring birds are really looking for that to help them fly efficiently. They get to that top of Lake Superior and they've got a choice, east or west. And some birds are going to go more towards the east, but the majority are going to go to the west because that really is kind of the beginning of the Mississippi Flyway, which is the flyway in the U.S. And most people know about the Mississippi Flyway, but most have no idea that 60 to 75% of the migratory birds in North America use that flyway,
mm-hmm.
most of them.
What type of bird could make it over the Big Lake in its
There are a few. Gulls, no problem. Osprey can do that. There's not very many.
Very cool.
You know, birds that are water birds from the get-go can do it.
So we were also wondering about other birds, particularly other large water birds, and if they were maybe constricted to this type of habitat. So maybe these are kind of the birds that are in between a gull and maybe a raptor, something like cranes, herons, geese, or ducks. Could you enlighten us a little bit on that?
Yeah. So a lot of it has to do with birds that flock and birds that don't. Sandhill cranes and American white pelicans, geese, ducks, they all flock, and so they're very easy to see when they're flying through. Loons will also do that. They'll not in a flock so much as individual birds, but they will pool on the big water because that's their primo habitat, and it's really not a reach for them to fly along and be along Lake Superior as they're cruising south. And so a lot of birds will stage on the Big Lake. Sandhills, cranes, not so much, but pelicans and geese and ducks and loons all will stage on Lake Superior. They need a day or two of rest. They can do that on the Big Lake without any problem. But others, like herons, they tend to be more individual birds and they tend to be more widely distributed to individual lakes, and they're not flocking birds for the most part. They won't travel in big groups. You more often than not see herons as individuals rather than big flocks.
Okay.
So yeah, we count them and see them, but it's a little different for those guys.
Sure. Margie, could I ask, would those singular migrating birds like herons, do they even travel in a family unit for the migration? Not so much?
Most birds don't
travel
in family units. Ducks and geese are somewhat of an exception to that, but for the most part, most don't. I always say it's like rush hour traffic. Everybody's headed the same direction, but nobody knows who's in the next car.
I love that. That's so interesting. So what are the cues that these birds are using? Maybe could you talk them generally, maybe passerines versus raptors use different cues, or are they all photo period, or is there some climate considerations that these birds are kind of paying attention to?
Well, if not climate, at least weather events, like really early cold or bad storms.
Right.
Or heat.
Do they,
like
they
now?
Initiate any of their movement?
Actually, this is an area where we don't know as much as we think we do, or we would like to know more. But in general, all birds pretty much fly and trigger their migration by food. Ask a group of kids what the trigger is, and they'll all say it gets cold. That's not it. It's food that is the main driver. Cold can be part of it because cold definitely plays a role in what disappears first kind of stuff. But it's a more complicated system than that. A lot of it has to do with distance the bird is going to fly. Some of these birds are going to go all the way from the Arctic to the Antarctic. So they have to be conscious of things. And research up to this point, and like I say, there's a lot more to be done, but research seems to indicate that those long-distance migrators more often than not get their cues from day length as it changes. But that doesn't hold true all the time, this being a year of warm temperatures and all kinds of other crazy wacko things happening.
Yes,
so indeed. The amount of distance they've got to go has part of it. But food tends to be the driver, and temperature more for shorter distance migrants rather than long distance migrants seem to be more driven by temperature and change in food sources. So yeah, it's a complicated set of stuff. And not only that, not everybody in the same species goes at the same time. Young birds will be the first to leave. You know, kind of the parental units have a conversation that goes something along the lines of, hey, it's been good to know you. Hope you do okay. Make good choices. Now scram. You can't come back here because this is our territory.
Okay.
The birds have got to go and figure out what to do.
Birds like the loon, I think they leave later than their parents. So it is also probably very species specific.
But in the majority of them, it's going to be the young birds that go first. Because they need a head start. They've got Mother Nature's first major test on the plate here. And for those young birds, that is the big one. The statistics go somewhere along the lines of 50, 60, even 75% of the birds that are born this year won't make it to their second year. This is a hard school of experiences.
Wow.
Once they've made it through that first migration, then their survival rate goes up dramatically after that. Yeah, those young birds are getting that head start.
Wow. The non-wildlife biologist in the group here, Leo, has a question to both of you, I guess, which is, I think of mammals as often stuffing themselves before the winter onset. You know, usually they're not migrating mammals that are doing that. Is there any way that a bird can get itself stocked up for the trip, or they're eating all along their migration, Margie? It's not really relevant that they try to jam the calories in before they hit the road. Maybe it's even counterindicated.
Well, some do and some don't. For example, I mean, one of my favorite migratory stories is black pole warblers. Oh, my word. Talk about blow your mind. These birds, many of them are coming from the interior of Alaska. When they start migrating, they migrate to the southeast. And as they migrate from their starting place to where they really take off, they're aiming for the Atlantic Ocean. Between when they start out and when they get to the Atlantic Ocean, they will double their body weight.
Wow.
Double. From about 11 grams to about 21 or 22 grams. And I always tell the kids, this is like having fuel in your tank. If you want to go somewhere, you better have some fuel in your tank. And some birds will just fuel up as they go. They'll stop. They'll run until they run out of fuel, and then they'll stop and refuel for a few days and then go on the next leg of the journey. Oh. But it varies a whole bunch. And these black pole warblers eventually hit the Atlantic Ocean. When they hit the Atlantic Ocean, they take off over water and travel 24 to 48 hours straight through over the water, flying at roughly 5-minute miles, human 5-minute miles,
right,
for 24 to 48 hours, based fully on the 11 grams or so of fat they've packed into their bodies. So, and yeah, just to put that in perspective, that's about half to two-thirds of a candy bar-sized Snickers bar.
So they're losing all that energy that they put on before that part of the marathon.
Well,
wow. Yep.
Talk about burning fat. That is incredible.
Yep, they're burning that.
It's getting them to their destinations, whatever they may be. Yeah,
exactly.
So there seems to be
equivalent. Let me just finish the tapper on the story. It's efficiency that ranks up there with 7,000 or more miles per gallon.
Wow.
Oh, my. Wow. That puts that's a good spin to put on it for us to put this in perspective. And though when they take off, whichever bird we're talking about, when they take off, if they've got to be fueling along the way, there's a lot of things that still need to go right for there to be food, you know, depending upon the year and the succession of when foods are available. So it's
well, exactly.
Remarkable.
And when you're on a migratory path, you don't have a GPS that says the restaurant's over here.
Yes.
No GPS system for the birds. No
wayside
no,
okay, signs.
Good habitat.
I'm going to give my participants here a 3-minute warning. We have to make sure that Michaela, any more biological mysteries that you have to explore with Margie Menzies today.
I mean, we made a lot of ground. I'm still amazed at how many birds are coming from the boreal forest. I'm really amazed at the numbers of birds. Is there any special thing that you'd like to fill us in about that I just haven't even touched on yet?
Well, I think weather is an interesting one this year. I was just looking at all of our raptor numbers for the season, and for most raptors, we're about on target for numbers because many of them come later. I always say that migration is like a parade, and you've got the beginning of the parade, the middle of the parade, and the end of the parade. And we are really kind of smack in the middle of the parade. But weather this year has been just wacko. We've been stuck in this east winds thing for over 2 weeks now, and that's really abnormal. And for many birds, this east wind is a bummer for migration. Many of the birds are good soaring birds, and that is just awful for them. Our soaring birds, for the most part, are all way behind on numbers, at least the ones that are coming earlier. The birds that we see the most every year are broadwing hawks, and we are way behind on our broadwing hawk migration. And the interesting thing is that when the weather breaks, and it's supposed to do that like Thursday or Friday this week, we may have floodgates because it's been massive. It's been continent-wide low-pressure systems just stuck here, which is very unusual. High-pressure systems usually drive the train, and there just hasn't been a strong enough one to drive the low pressures out. And so if you've been looking at weather maps, like some of us geeky types do, the whole country has been at low-pressure system. And that tends to be unfavorable winds for those birds to move that are dependent on soaring kinds of things. And so what they'll do in normal circumstances is go around. But there's been no go around this year because everything's been horrid. So
wow.
The question is, what's going to happen?
Do they stay hunkered while the wind is not favorable? Are they, you know, using that local habitat that they landed in to sustain themselves before the weather lifts or while the weather lifts?
That's exactly what typically happens for those soaring birds. I'm referring specifically to broadwing hawks, which are the birds that we see more of than anything else every year, at least in the raptor, on average, the raptor species that we see the most of. And yeah, ordinarily we see somewhere between 30 and 40,000 birds coming through, and we're at 6,000 and some. So we are way behind. That should be mostly over. So the question is, did they find a way around like they usually do when it's really, really bad? Or did they just hunker down and wait it out? It's been exceptionally warm this year. There hasn't been a lot of things to give them a kick in the pants to get going. Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens towards the end of the week and moving forward with the rest of the migration, because so many things have been stalled. I mean, even I'm a passerine bander, songbirds, and some of them are way behind. I'm still catching all kinds of early season warblers and things like that. So things are just a little bit crazy this year.
Well,
so it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Absolutely. Do we have any way to scout where these birds that may be, you know, staying on the ground more or less, where they're hunkered down? Do we have any idea?
Oh, sure. I mean,
okay.
You know, they're, like I say, they're staying in the boreal
forest.
They're taking advantage. I mean, local places that you can go where you can see these birds hunkered down. Park Point is a great place in Duluth to really see things. That sand spit grabs a lot of birds as they come through, particularly waterfowl, shorebirds, warblers, all of that kind of stuff. Western Waterfront Trail all along the St. Louis River is great places to be looking for these birds. So yeah, there's, you know, Hawk Ridge where you can see them flying over, but you can also go to the places where they're hunkered down and see lots of birds busily feeding and fattening themselves up and hoping the winds change direction.
Wow. Well, you've been a font of great information and enthusiasm about bird watching and the opportunities we have in this area where we're very fortunate. I've been speaking with Margie Menzies today. Margie, do you have anything to share with people about those who haven't been regulars at Hawk Ridge? Anything about what they should expect or prepare for with clothing or equipment to take it in well? Any first-timer suggestions?
Well, okay, so bring your chair to sit in if you want to sit down. We do have rocks along the overlook, but the chairs are much better seating.
For your back.
Yeah, bring your binoculars, bring your spotting scope, travel with all your layers in your car. But I always tell my staff, like, carry your whole wardrobe in your car and you'll be fine. Because it can change. It can be, we get what I call the Lake Superior special a lot, which is fogged in and drippy, rainy, drizzly kinds of stuff. And then, boom, it'll all clear out and we'll be back to watching everything fly through. Even in the fog, you can see things flying through. And my favorite are those early season snowstorms, and the birds will migrate in some of those as well. And you can see these beautiful rough-legged hawks come whizzing out of the snowstorm, out of the snow.
Wow.
It's pretty cool.
Margie, you're painting a great picture, even on radio, of what awaits people that go up to Hawk Ridge. Thanks so much for joining us. You have any parting words for our guest, Michaela?
Well, I would love to have her back sometime to talk about just bird education in general. And thank you so much for your time and giving us these really interesting details that Leo and I just couldn't figure out for ourselves. So thanks
Happy
for being
to do it. It's great fun.
Thank you.
It was a delight. Thank you so much, Margie. We hope to have you again sometime. And meanwhile, we'll see you on the radio, as we like to joke to our guests. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
You take care now.
Okay.
That's Margie Menzies, the education director at the Hawk Ridge Bird Observatory in Duluth, Minnesota.